This is Fresh Air. Frank Browning is a journalist who is gay. On the job, he says, he used to keep his sexual identity neither hidden nor open. But in the late 80s, while reporting from San Francisco on the AIDS epidemic for NPR, he became more involved with the gay subculture. He started wondering, is there a gay culture comparable to other ethnic and racial cultures? He explores that question in his new book, The Culture of Desire, Paradox and Perversity in Gay Lives Today. Browning is a former full-time reporter for NPR. You may have also heard him guest host Fresh Air a few years back. He now divides his time between San Francisco and Kentucky, where his family has an apple orchard. He used to be skeptical that gay men could fabricate their own culture. What does he think now?
I think there is a dream of a gay culture. And that culture, I think there is something like it. I'm still uncomfortable with whether it exists, but there's something out there that has cohered now in public for a quarter of a century that has connections to something that was very subterranean for at least a century before that. And so I do see, you know, the post-Stonewall macho clone generation passing on certain ways of being, certain ways of behaving to the younger queer men and women who are trying to figure out a civil rights agenda, figure out a sexual agenda, figure out a male-female agenda. I see a sense of passing on. Where it's going to lead, whether it's going to mean that the West Village and the East Village in New York and the Castro district in San Francisco and West Hollywood, whether it's going to mean that all those places persist for 500 years as the meccas of gay culture, well, I don't know. I kind of doubt that. But I think there is this kind of collective self-reflection that has begun over the last quarter century to take place that tell us, yes, there are cultural continuities between those of us who think of ourselves as queer. And what's most exciting is a lot of the time it's begun to draw in a fair number of straight people who are not so sure they're straight anymore and begin to think of queer as an exciting thing.
Frank, let me ask you, do you think you can recognize people who are gay? Can you tell?
In America, pretty much.
How?
No, but let me say what I mean.
Uh-huh.
Gay is, for the most part, a white, middle-class, male construction. There are a lot of men who have sex with each other who don't fit that category, and a lot of them are very uncomfortable with the idea of gay. So,
but because by gay you're implying a whole lifestyle that goes along with it?
Yeah, it...
A whole set of cultural attitudes?
Certain set of attitudes, a certain set of books that you've read. It's a certain sort of litmus test of if you will, gay cultural literacy, right? And so when I go to Brazil, I mean, at times I wonder if there's anybody who's straight there. That's what an anthropologist once told me about Brazil as well, because the notion of sexual identity is so fluid. How do I notice it here? It's a certain sense of irony about how you conduct yourself. And we're talking about men here. I mean, it's as though, yeah, I look like a man. I can walk down the street just like you do. But, hey, what? You know, there's something else going on here. And so you're sort of seeing yourself with an extra eye in as you walk down. And you pretend, you sort of have all the trappings of a conventional of a conventional guy who's trained to sort of get his own way and run the world, and yet there is this irony which leads to what Susan Sontag a long time ago called camp, that way of knowing that fate gave you a double deck, and you're both a male in a conventional way and you're not one, and you're always playing at the theater of who you are, and that shows up. At the simplest level, when you're horny, you look at each other in the eye the way straight men never do, and you say, mm-hmm.
In your book, you write that the examination of gayness might tell us as much about the portion of America that isn't gay as it does about the portion that is. What do you think you learned about the portion of America that isn't gay by investigating the portion that is gay?
You learn about fear. I was several years ago, a close friend and I were serving on... We were serving the board of the National Writers Union. We were having this conversation. And I said, John, do you think that we're wired different neurologically? Or do you think it's learned? And this is a very open, straight man. And he said, well, no, I think it is culture. I think we are, in all the ways that Freud and others describe, trained to suppress certain of our sensual experiences. And the question I always want to ask is, oh dear, why? Why at this point, when all of the structures of behavior and family tradition and all those things we've inherited about how it is to behave are in such flux, why would one be so fearful? That's the issue in the military question. The question, I mean, nobody, isn't it interesting right now on this whole military question? All the reporting is, or nearly all of it, doesn't seem to be about what are those awful homosexuals doing. It's what's going to happen to our poor straight boys? You know, can they handle it? Can they take it? Can they take having a guy look at them? Will they go bananas and start shooting, or will they simply wilt under that, you know, that dreadful stare of this superhuman homosexual who's going to ravage a whole barracks, you know? I mean, it's fascinating to me, you know. We're the tigers, and the straights are the poofs. I mean, isn't this bizarre? I mean, roll the film back 10 years ago. What are they afraid of? And that's part of what I say. That's part of what is interesting to me. Other things that are interesting to me about what we learn about straight people, so-called, if there are, I guess there are a few people who are absolutely genetically straight, is how we handle tenderness and how we handle intimacy, how we handle caregiving. What are we learning from the way gay men in San Francisco or Lexington or New York, what are we learning from what they have done taking care of their own, of our own, in this epidemic that may help the baby boom generation deal with getting old, you know? What happened in San Francisco in the wake of the AIDS epidemic is that it cost half as much to take care of people with AIDS as it did anywhere else in America, and that is because these extended families that were created did it. They built volunteer systems. They constructed ways for people to have a life in the face of death.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Frank Browning, and he's written a new book called The Culture of Desire, Paradox, and Perversity in Gay Lives today. Frank, let's take a short break, and then we'll come back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Frank Browning. In the late 80s, he reported on the AIDS epidemic for NPR. When you were an AIDS reporter, was it the first time that you were reporting on a story that you were really close to? People who you knew or you might have known, as opposed to, like, an issue that you were pretty far away from?
No, it was the closest I've ever been to a story that mattered deeply to me. But you know, journalism for me has always been a technique of finding out what I care about. Journalism is a way to ask questions that you maybe are afraid to ask if you didn't have the excuse of the microphone and the notepad. It's a way of behaving in the world and making sense of things. I mean, the last book I wrote was about crime. I wanted to understand deviance and crime in America, and the way I figured it out was to write a book about it.
You know, what you're saying reminds me of something. I've often said that I can ask anything to anyone if it's in the professional context of an interview, and that I'd ask things of strangers in an interview sooner than I'd ask them of friends. And something I found is that sometimes if I'm interviewing someone who has AIDS, I really will ask anything with their permission. But with a friend who has AIDS, I'm much more kind of careful about assessing their mood, what they feel like talking about. Do you know what I mean? Do I want to talk about this more? Do they not want to? Do you know what I'm saying? I find them more forward with the microphone, even when it comes to illness.
Sure. A microphone is a license to invade. A microphone is a license to not only to invade, but to take that story and make it your own. That's what we're paid to do. That's what our obligation is to do. But that's not what we do with the people we love. And every now and then I found myself in a very personal conversation, and the other person will say, "You're interviewing. You're interviewing me." And I pull back and I say, "Oh, I am, aren't I?" Because there is something. There's something nasty about journalism. And that nastiness is that you feel as though you have the peremptory right to invade the finest, most obscure intimacy and turn it into your trade, or if you're good, into your art. I think painters do the same thing. I mean, this is what Janet Malcolm said about all writing, isn't it? I mean, writers are traitors. You know, we come in, we tell you we're going to repeat your story, but we don't. We come in, we get the details of your story, and we use it to explain our own stories.
When you were reporting on AIDS, you had to use a completely different kind of language than you, when you were reporting on issues. I mean, other issues, you know, more political issues rather than issues of health and the body and of the sexual transmission of the virus. What kinds of dilemmas did you face about the kind of language to use when you were talking about sex and AIDS?
Well, there are the obvious ones, like, you know, what are the rules? Can you talk about anal intercourse this week or not? And that's changed at NPR from time to time, just as it did at the Washington Post and the New York Times. Those are kind of, what do they call it in the networks, standards and procedures or something like that. The more difficult one is, how much do you tell? You know, if you know something special, how much do you tell? How much do you dare to try to explain the complex relationship to sexuality and intimacy that has developed in the last 25 years of gay life? Can you really get that across with muffin and coffee at 6:45 in the morning, knowing that people are trying to dress the kids? Or if you talk about it in telegraphic journalistic language, does it simply seem as though you're pandering and sensational and looking for the hot tape cut that's going to get letters? You know, everybody likes letters. It doesn't matter whether they're good letters or bad letters. You like letters. But that was difficult to me. So that led to a third level of language, and that is, how could I imply the ordinariness of gay lives without pointing it out? You know, how could I refer to someone's lover who was sitting by making coffee as sort of by the by, you know, and let people know that these were human beings going about their lives trying to survive and continue? And you know, it's funny. I went, when I was the last AIDS assignment I had at NPR as a full-time staff member, I was out at the AIDS conference in 1990. And I had my little dog tag on and my microphone in my hand, and people were out there chanting, making a ruckus. And this guy came up to me. He was from North Carolina. And he looked at me. And I guess, I was talking with a friend of mine. I may have had my arm around him or something like that. Okay. And this guy from North Carolina came up to me and he said, "Uh-huh. I've been listening to your reports. I thought so. I thought you were queer." And I said, "How?" He said, "I don't know. It was just something about accepting without question the naturalness of the relations that you were talking about. Something about the language in which you didn't distance yourself. You didn't talk about gay people as those people, but simply as ordinary people."
You've subtitled your book Paradox and Perversity in Gay Lives today. What are the paradoxes that you're thinking about?
The paradoxes... To be a guy who looks like a regular guy out there, but really isn't, you know, that's one of them. To have the gall to suppose that you can make a culture out of nothing more than longing, which is almost the antithesis of the idea of a culture. It's Oscar Wilde, I quote, who said, you know, what paradox was to me in the realm of thought, perversity was in the realm of the senses. And that we all live with enormous numbers of masks that we're continuously changing back and forth. You know, here I am, the reporter doing pieces for National Public Radio, and here I am, the apple grower, in which I sort of slip back into my Kentucky accent a little bit, though it's not real strong. And it's not phony. It just happens when I'm there. And... here I am, somebody who's terribly interested in the crises of Bruno Bettelheim, and I have all these personas, and I sort through them, and I find a life, and I don't feel too schizophrenic or any more than seems healthy. I think my sexual desire is primarily homosexual, and yet I don't live in a gay ghetto. I think of this whole new generation of young queer people who don't often call themselves gay. Who revel in the queerness of having sex with women, even though they went there with a guy. You know, these things are linked. It's the unknowableness of it all that is what I celebrate as perversity. I think perversity is fantastic. It's what makes us be alive.
You celebrate perversity?
Sure, sure. Pray that we all be more perverse.
Why?
Because perverse is a recognition that life is a mystery. I mean, if you're not perverse, then you have no sense of irony. You think you know all the answers. You know who you are. Well, as soon as you know who you are, you're dead. There's no more living. There's no more questions. There's no more search. Huh? Thank you, no.
Frank Browning, his new book is called The Culture of Desire. This is Fresh Air.